Our subject this evening is science. And I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the logical difficulties with science. Now, to say anything negative about science, and by science I don't mean it in the King James sense, but science in the sense of the physical or the natural sciences. To say anything negative about it today is almost blasphemous in some circles. The attitude is, or seems to be among many people, that science is so obviously successful. We have computers in almost every home. We have televisions in two televisions for every home. We've put men on the moon. We have invented and made all these technological discoveries. Anyone who criticizes science in the 20th century, any Christian, is just backward if he does so. And for some people, even some Christians, that seems to be the attitude, that science is unassailable. It is obvious that it provides us with truth. And if science contradicts the Bible on some point, then we as Christians have to revise our understanding of the Bible. So if science shows that evolution occurred, then we have to rethink Genesis 1 and 2, or whatever it might be. If science shows some other fact of nature, then we have to revise our understanding of the Bible. We cannot believe that a book that was written 2,000 years ago can stand up to the, what shall we say, the epistemological prowess of modern science. Well, I don't mean to be criticizing science just for the sake of criticizing science. I think it's important, though, to realize what science is and how science fits into a Christian view of men and things. The role of science for many, including many Christians, is as a road to truth or a way of discovering truth. Perhaps not about God, but certainly about the world around us. I would suggest that the role of science is something completely different from that. The purpose of science in a Christian view of men and things is to enable us to subdue the earth. The command in Genesis given to Adam was to subdue the earth. And science has a great role to play in performing that duty. But as a tool of cognition, it is a complete failure. Now, many scientists used to say that science was adequate. Science was capable of providing us with truth. Carl Pearson, earlier in this century, wrote that the goal of science is clear. It is nothing short of the complete interpretation of the universe. That's the goal of science, according to Carl Pearson. A very famous American scientist, Robert Millikan, who won the Nobel Prize in Physics, wrote, "In science, truth once discovered always remains truth." Well, of course, you would expect that truth always remains truth. What is true today has to be true tomorrow, and it was true yesterday. The question is he speaking accurately when he says truth in science, once discovered, always remains truth? There are about six areas that I would like to touch on briefly this evening where I'll criticize science, and I'll put them up here on the overhead so that you can remember them all. The first point I want to make is that observation is unreliable. Now, this isn't a course in epistemology, so again, I'm not going to go into all the things that might be said about the problems of observation But if you'll just think of the scientific method itself, let's imagine that we're scientists working in our laboratories and we're performing an experiment on something. Do we as scientists perform the experiment once? No, of course not. We do it repeatedly. Why do we do it repeatedly? Well, because there's a chance that the first time we did it, we looked at the gauge or the thermometer or whatever it might be incorrectly. Perhaps we blinked and missed something. Perhaps we were nodding off. Perhaps we had a fight with our wife that morning and we can't see what the gauge says correctly. There are any number of possibilities, and in the scientific method itself, they try to overcome these by doing experiments and taking readings repeatedly. They don't do them just one because they realize that observation is unreliable. The scientific method entails a controlled situation in which as few distractions as possible can interfere. When the scientist gets done, he publishes his findings so that others can perform the experiment. Scientists will usually tell you that if an experiment cannot be repeated, if they get irreproducible results, then the whole experiment is thrown out. They may have gotten the results once or a few times, but if after they publish their findings, other scientists can't reproduce those results, the results are usually ignored. In fact, there's an hilarious journal, I think it's still being published, for those of you who want to read some funny scientific articles, called the Journal of Irreproducible Results, in which the authors very cleverly concoct the wildest experiments that you can imagine and publish them in the journal and for their colleagues to read and howl about. I recall one of the articles a few years ago was on mat cows, how some scientists had realized that Holstein cows were really maps of the world. And he published his findings in the Journal of Irreproducible Results about all these map cows running around. But anyway, that's my first criticism of the scientific method, is that while realizing observation is unreliable and trying to overcome it, scientists do not overcome it. It cannot be overcome, as a matter of fact, as a way of learning truth or discovering truth. The second one is a little bit different, and we mentioned this in the second hour this evening. All experimentation commits the fallacy of asserting the consequence. All experimentation in the scientific method commits this logical fallacy. The fallacy, if you recall, was if P, then Q, Q, therefore P. Asserting the consequent. I assert Q, the consequent. The example I gave was, if my battery is dead, my car won't start. My car won't start, therefore my battery is dead. In something simple and practical like that, we can see that it's a mistake in reasoning. But it's always a mistake, not just in dealing with cars that won't run. What's the scientist do? And how is his method involved in this fallacy? Well, a scientist comes up with an hypothesis. And if we want to stick with this example I've given, the hypothesis is, if my battery is dead, my car won't start. That's the hypothesis. Then he tries to, from that hypothesis, deduce some predicted result. Something that should occur if that hypothesis is true, such as my car won't start. That should occur if the hypothesis is true. Then he will come up with a controlled experiment to test the hypothesis to see if the predicted result occurs. The experiment, if we're going to stick with this illustration again, I get in my car and I turn the key. That's the experiment. What is the result? My car doesn't start. The scientist in his laboratory comes up with an hypothesis, makes a prediction about the result from that hypothesis, performs an experiment. Let's assume he gets the prediction he expected. We then say, well, the hypothesis is confirmed. And as soon as you hear those words, bells and sirens should go off in your mind. It's a very good example of the fallacy of asserting the consequent. There may be any number of reasons why he got the result that he predicted, not just the one that his hypothesis was based on. There may be any number of reasons, just as there may be any number of reasons that your car won't start. The formal logic is the same whether you're working in a laboratory or a garage. The mechanic won't make the mistake in the reasoning, but the scientist will. He'll say, my theory is confirmed. It's important to realize that the scientific method has this logical fallacy at its heart. Go ahead. Go ahead and ask them.
Well, first of all, the question I ask you is, I think my wife is just suggesting.
Sure.
When is science, mathematics, science?
No, I've defined it as natural sciences.
Okay. So if I can mathematically show that the car won't start, then
if you could mathematically show that, then you would have a proof.
Okay.
All right. Any other questions? Anything that involves experimentation, and certainly the scientific method involves experimentation, as a way of arriving at this conclusion, commits this fallacy. Well, things get worse. Induction is always a fallacy, with the qualification, of course, that if you can complete the induction, then there's no problem. Unfortunately, science cannot complete the induction. Scientists are not interested in making statements like, some atoms have X properties. They want to make general statements. They want to make statements about atoms. They want to make statements about light. They want to make statements about physical bodies. They want to make statements about sound. So they always, in their induction, commit the fallacy of induction or hasty generalization, if you want to use that phrase. They always go beyond the evidence. They will collect information on certain instances of light, certain wavelengths, certain atoms, whatever the case may be, but they will always wish to make statements about the general categories, atoms or light or sound or chemical compounds or whatever it might be. Not having observed all those specific cases, not being able to observe all those specific cases. So they have a problem with induction. Number four here, equations are selected, not discovered. Let me try to explain what I mean by that. Again, take yourself back to a laboratory, a scientific laboratory, and you're performing an experiment. Let's make it something simple, like trying to determine the boiling point of water. You heat up the water in your test tube or whatever, take a reading, and you get a result. And the result is 100 degrees centigrade. But you don't stop there, of course. You do it again. You perform the experiment again, and you get a slightly different result this time. It's 100.02 degrees centigrade. And you continue performing the experiment until you have an array of values in front of you, all hovering around, let's assume, the 100 degrees centigrade mark, but, you know, within a range of maybe 500ths or 1/10ths of a point, of a degree. Well, what do you do with this? What do you do with this information? Well, you average it. Now, how many averages are there? Has anybody had any mathematics and studied averages? Well, I don't know if I'd go that far, but there are quite a few. The three basic ones that are usually listed are the mean, the mode, and the median. When we talk about average in everyday language, we think of the mean. We don't think of the mode or the median. The scientist in his laboratory now has to make a decision. There's nothing in the experimental evidence that says choose the mean over the mode or the median. There's no requirement that he choose any of the three. He makes a decision. He selects his average. Well, let's assume he continues with his experimentation. And he develops readings of several sorts. Let's assume he moves his laboratory up to 1,000 feet above sea level, or moves it down to sea level if he's done it at a different altitude, and he gets different temperatures for the boiling point of water. Well, he's going to, at some point, have to take, not only calculate an average of some sort, he's going to have to calculate a variable error in all his readings. And he's finally going to end up, if he wishes to do it this way, with a graph, an x and y axis on a graph, and he will enter all his so-called data points on that graph. He may actually put in the numbers he gets or his averages on that graph. And then he will perhaps draw a curve through it and come up with a rule of physics that the boiling point of water varies with the altitude or distance from sea level. Well, let me ask you this question. Let's assume he has a graph with, 20 data points on it. How many curves can he draw through those data points? Each curve, keep in mind, describes a different equation. How many curves can he draw through those data points? How many lines can he draw through them? Well, I heard it. It's an infinite number. He can draw an infinite number of curves through those data points. But he only draws one. Now, what is the probability of his choosing the correct curve, the correct equation, out of an infinite number of possibilities? Zero. He has no chance of drawing the correct curve, choosing the correct equation out of an infinite number of possibilities. Equations are selected, not discovered. Yes. because they're the most rigorous. It would be a lot easier to take care of archaeology or geology. Well, let me ask you, let's back up a little bit. Where did you get the constant from? Yeah. Yeah, in the back there? Actually, behind the constant is exactly the situation I've described, a bunch of raw data. That's true. That's true. My point is, or at least one of my points is, we ought not base our eternal life on the sort of assumptions and calculations and guaranteed error that the scientific method affords us. If you're going to decide about eternal life and what you're going to base your eternal life on, it has to be something with a more solid foundation than the scientific method. But let me go on. Let me draw out some further implications here from these six areas that I've mentioned. Number six, let's skip to number six for the time being, since we've talked about laboratory method a little bit. All the laws derived by this method have to be false. If the possibility of choosing the correct one is one out of infinity, then none of the equations is correct. It has to be false. Which statement?
The fact that the probability is zero, then you make the next argument that the equation
that you have no, I don't know how the word validity is used there, but the equations are not true. They're all false. And the final one, number five here, scientific laws describe ideals. One of the standard examples given about this is the law of the pendulum, about the period of the pendulum varying with the length of the pendulum string or whatever it might be. Well, if you look into the assumptions of that law, it assumes that the string is tensionless, that the mass of the bob of the pendulum is concentrated at a geometrical point, that the axis of the pendulum is frictionless. There is no pendulum in existence that meets those qualifications. So the law of the pendulum describes no actually existing pendulum. There are ideal conditions that it applies to, but it applies to no physical pendulum in no laboratory. We're not talking about grandfather clocks. We're talking about the most scientific a pendulum that might appear in any laboratory. It cannot meet these conditions. These are ideal conditions. The law has no application to anything less than an ideal condition. It does not describe any actually existing pendulum. Now, let me give you some quotes, if I might. And maybe if some of you have read your handouts, you've seen these already, from some leading figures in science and philosophy. Let me begin with Bertrand Russell. He certainly was highly respected for his ability in philosophy and mathematics at the beginning of the century. And this is what he had to say about the scientific method. And I quote, "All inductive arguments in the last resort reduce themselves to the following form." Notice the word form again. He gives this example. "If this is true, that is true. Now that is true, therefore this is true." This is the fallacy of asserting the consequent. If this is true, that is true. If it's true, my battery is dead. It's true, my car won't start. Now that is true, that my car won't start. Therefore it's true, my battery is dead. He says the argument is, of course, formally fallacious. Suppose I were to say, if bread is a stone, and stones are nourishing, then this bread will nourish me. Now this bread does nourish me, therefore it is a stone, and stones are nourishing. If I were to advance such an argument, he says, I should certainly be thought foolish. Yet it would not be fundamentally different from the arguments upon which all scientific laws are based. Now, Bertrand Russell was no Christian. He wrote a little book called Why I Am Not a Christian. He was very anti-Christian, but he was clear-headed enough to see the problem, or one of the problems, in the scientific method. This argument, which he describes as foolish, is not fundamentally different from the arguments upon which all scientific laws are based. So it's not a Christian that is pointing out why the scientific method can't provide us with truth, but Bertrand Russell. Let me quote Karl Popper, if I might, if I can put my finger on the quote. Karl Popper is a leading, or was a leading, philosopher of science and a citizen of England. He wrote a number of books which are well worth reading. And this is what he wrote in a book called, I believe the first quote is from Conjectures and Refutations. You see this sentence here at the bottom, science is at best conjectures and refutations. Not truth, it's conjectures, guesses, if you want a better English word. Guesses and refutations of guesses. But it is not truth. Here's Popper. First, although in science we do our best to find the truth, we are conscious of the fact that we can never be sure whether we have got it. We know that our scientific theories always remain hypotheses. Notice the qualifiers here, like never and always. In science, there is no knowledge, and he italicizes knowledge, in the sense in which Plato and Aristotle understood the word, or I might add, in the sense in which the Bible understands the word, in the sense which implies finality. After all, if something is true, it is eternally true. It's always true. In science, we never, and I'm not adding these words, these are in Popper, the nevers and the always. In science, we never have sufficient reason for the belief that we have attained the truth. Einstein declared that, and this is what Popper italicizes, his theory was false. Einstein declared that his theory was false. He said that it would be a better approximation to the truth than Newton's, but he gave reasons why he would not, even if all predictions came out right, regarded as a true theory. Now, I'm not quoting Christians. I'm quoting people who are hostile to Christianity, writing about science. In another book, Popper has these words: "Our attempts to see and to find the truth are not final, but open to improvement. Our knowledge, our doctrine, is conjectural. It consists of guesses, of hypotheses, rather than of final and certain truths." And finally, a quote from Einstein, if I could give this. This is from the biography of Einstein by Ronald Clark. If anybody wants to read the book, it's called Einstein, The Life and Times. It's an account of a conversation that Einstein had with a visitor, and they were outside on a summer trip on a riverboat, and Einstein suddenly looks up at the sky, at the clear skies, and he says, "We know nothing about it at all. All our knowledge is but the knowledge of school children. Do you think," the visitor asked, "that we shall ever probe the secret?" "Possibly," he said with a movement of his shoulders, "we shall know a little more than we know now, but the real nature of things, that we shall never know, never." Now that's Einstein's view of science. Popper quoted him as saying that his theory was false, and he gave reasons why he thought his theory was false. My question to you at this point is, if the arguments I have presented are valid, if science, the scientific method, is a tissue of logical fallacies, why are Christian apologists bothering to defend science and to try to base the doctrines of the Bible on science? Well, it's because they don't understand the situation, I guess. Here you have people preemptively surrendering. You have some of the leading philosophers in the 20th century preemptively surrendering and say, "We cannot discover truth." Well, we know they can't. We've looked at the logical situation. The method cannot discover truth. So why do we not listen to them and quote Popper and Einstein and Bertrand Russell in our literature, rather than trying to defend the methods of science? Go ahead.
My only point there would be, and
go ahead.
I have no idea really what you're talking about. Would it be more that what the scientists are trying to do in this regard of Christians who are becoming Christians? Should be like the idea of what kind of reason we trust God rather than being
real? Well, I think in many cases that's exactly the case. I disagree in this sense. I don't think that the evidentialist theologians who inhabit the scientific creationist movement are arguing ad hominem. I think they really feel that the arguments are valid. And they're attempting to base the truth of the Bible or the existence of God on these arguments.
So they're not very valid?
No, the arguments are not valid. No, was it last night I talked about empirical apologetics? The arguments aren't valid. Yes, sir.
To claim to
reject God. If we can prove by their method, using their truth, argument, that Jesus isn't as easily having for the existence of God as Jesus, using their method, then forget whether it's true or not, there's no real difference. If you can introduce doubt in their mind, perhaps this is all you need to prove that those two methods that they're using are
before
God as easily as against the
one that's taken down. Well, you recall the ad hominem argument is you accept something they say and then argue validly to a conclusion that they will not accept or are not presently accepting anyway. You have to use valid argument in the ad hominem form of argument. You can't use invalid arguments. Although I've read one recent apologist who seems to think that if you know an argument's invalid, yet you feel it will be persuasive, go ahead and use it. And that seems to me to be pure fraud, pure dishonesty to do something like that. But in the ad hominem argument, you have to argue validly. But what we should be doing is every time a scientist stands up, like Carl Sagan or whoever, popularizer of science, quote Bertrand Russell to them. Embarrass them. Tell them when they get their act together, they can speak. But embarrass them in the meantime. Usually the argument that I get from an audience is, but science is so successful. It's given us all these things, the microwaves and the atom bomb. It's so successful. How can you argue with success? And again, you have to keep in mind that there's a big difference between truth and success, and false theories can work. Many people are surprised to hear that, but false theories can work. Suppose I were to tell you tonight that, Portland is north of Vancouver. You would certainly say, that's a falsehood. And if I pursue that and act on that, where will I get? Eventually to Portland. I will get to the North Pole. Then I'm going south. Suppose I tell you, to use a different example, Portland, well, not all false theories work. Suppose I tell you that Portland is, east of, what's the latitude here? I have no idea what the latitude is here. What are you across from, Boston, New York? What if we say that Portland is east of, or Boston is west of Portland? He'd say, it's obviously false. But if I travel west, I'll get to Boston. Clark gives the example in one of his essays of the milk fever in cows. And medical science is replete with such examples. Milk fever was a disease that sometimes killed cows in the early part of the century, or the last part of the 19th century. And people didn't know why. The germ theory of disease hadn't been put forth yet. But then Pasteur put forth his theory, and some veterinarian decided, well, let's inject an antiseptic solution into the cow's udder and see if that cures the milk fever. So he did so. The vet injected the antiseptic solution. And sure enough, the cow got better. So he kept doing this, and word spread. Now, the cure rate wasn't 100%. It hardly ever is. But most of the cows got better. Until one day, a veterinarian was caught without his antiseptic solution. So he said, well, the farmer doesn't know any different. I'll use some sterile water. So he injected sterile water. He thought he wouldn't be found out, since a few cows always died anyway, even after treatment. And to his surprise, the cow recovered. after injecting the sterile water. What's the status now of the germ theory of milk fever? Today, milk fever, it's still with us. Hasn't been cured yet. It's still with the Holsteins, I guess. Today, I believe it's treated by oral doses of calcium. They give the cattle large pills, calcium pills, and that's how they treat milk fever today. It seems to have the most successful rate of curing milk fever. Well, what's the status of the germ theory? It worked, didn't it? Putting the antiseptic solution, even putting the sterile water in the cow worked. But the accepted wisdom today is that you treat it with oral doses of calcium. And science, if you read a history of science, has several stories like that of things, false theories, theories which are now regarded as false, working. So false theories sometimes work. Truth, it's not required for success that a theory be true. But true theories will always work. False theories sometimes may not work. But there's no problem with believing that science does not provide us with truth, yet sometimes works. Yes, sir. Some portion of no, the probability is zero. There's no probability greater than zero. No. We don't learn things through the scientific method. We learn them by revelation. If you want to learn truth, you read your Bible. Study the Bible. You don't go out and perform experiments and collect data. It's the method that's wrong. If you're going to say that's the only method we have, then yes, your conclusion would follow. We can't learn truth. But it's not the only method. It is the method most widely respected in the modern world. Well, in a scientific context, it's a value with a variable error of zero. That's how I defined it. That's true. If there's an error there, it's not true. Well, they have a looser definition, a false definition. It's a definition that involves error. So it's not true.